Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Locus Roundtable podcast. We're here this week with Karen Ward, who has recently this year won both the Crawford and the Mythopoeic Awards for her debut novel, Redemption in Indigo. And she's joining us from her home in Barbados. Hello, Karen.
Hi, Karen. You know, I think Karen is a good name to have in the sci-fi world. I'm encountering a lot of Karens.
Yeah, to be in the same company as Karen Joy Fowler is an honor.
Absolutely. Yes, so you promised me a talk about science.
Yes, science, because it turns out, as we found out when we were both at the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts, which is our overwhelmingly awesome academic convention for...
It is, it definitely is. I highly recommend it.
That we both have physics degrees, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that you've also done a master's degree in, I believe you said, science and technology policy.
That's right, yeah.
Which sounds absolutely fascinating.
It wasn't too bad. It was pretty cool. It basically takes, how to put it? There's always this sort of translation gap between the learning of the science and the researching of the science and the applying of it, especially at the governmental level. And a master's of that sort is basically saying, well, this is how you actually go to your government and get things done. Theoretically.
and that absolutely matters. And one thing I've found interesting is that I got my bachelor's in physics. I finished last year a master's in electrical engineering. And I work as an engineer. But another thing I found really valuable is, since I've started also doing writing and being involved in the writing community, communication. The communication science is critical and so often handled poorly.
Oh, yes. Oh, dear. Yeah.
It seems like the Venn diagram of people who both really understand the tough science concepts and can communicate to a general audience is vanishingly small.
Yes, that's true. And I don't know if you've ever encountered this, but sometimes when I talk to, well, let's call them the scientific lay person, I realize that the average person's understanding of science... I'm talking about things that you think you know, not things that you've actually, like, you know, say you have a side interest in geography, so you crack open a book every once in a while. I'm talking about the things that you don't really research, but you sort of think you have a vague idea, well, it's like this. Some of these beliefs, some of these ideas are so outdated. We're talking turn of the century, and I don't mean this one outdated. And it's actually quite scary sometimes. I've heard people who are very, very knowledgeable in some other topic, be it politics or linguistics or what have you, and you're having an amazing discussion with them, and then all of a sudden they'll decide to break into the science area and they'll say something you're kind of like, actually, no. And you're just kind of cringing and wondering how to break it to them that they've suddenly dropped about, you know, five levels of education with what you just said.
Well, we had talked a little earlier about, or over email, I was so happy when you used the word hypothesis to mean an actual testable hypothesis. I was like, wow, because that's one of those words that everyone uses, but...
And doesn't quite know what it means, yeah.
Exactly, and never in the scientific sense.
Yeah. And that's true because, that's a very good point, because there are things that you have to be aware when people are using it in a casual or a conversational sense, and when they're using it in a precise sense. Especially when it comes to, I think in conversation it's not so bad, but when I see somebody's writing an essay or even writing a blog post, I don't know why it is that I seem to expect greater precision from the written word, but I do.
Absolutely.
And that's what throws me off, especially journalists. I'm sorry, I'm kind of distracted here, aren't I? You were talking about literature. That is what we were supposed to be discussing, isn't
it? Literature. But it does tie in, because, of course, you know, the field of science fiction and fantasy have always had this relationship with science. And a lot of the readers feel, again, like fairly educated laymen. But science, it seems like there's such a huge spectrum of how you encounter science across the genres.
Yes.
And, for instance, I was saying that Redemption in Indigo is winning awards as a fantasy novel, and of course it's got gods and zombies and all all those fairly mythical beings, but a lot of the powers that the gods and that the heroine has are expressed in metaphors that I found scientific.
I'm glad that you, and it's funny, they're not everybody picked that up, but I'm glad you picked it up. I have to mention, though, I don't quite think of the beings as gods.
Okay. I was wondering if I was using the wrong word there.
Well, it's kind of hard. I have seen some reviewers use the term gods, and it's sort of a general sort of wood and water spirit sense, or even in a kind of Narnia sense, you know, wood gods and water gods and so forth. Yes, you could say that's right. But I guess I'm thinking ahead of the structure I have in terms of the sequels.
Ah, okay.
And that's why I'm starting to think all these little hierarchies. And it's like, well, no, they're below the angels, so they can't be gods. But anyway, sorry, giving stuff away. Yes, they do have powers, but I also think to myself that even when I'm reading fantasy, I always think to myself, powers must have a logic. They must have a reason. I've seen some people write fantasy where they may not give a kind of a real world explanation for it, however hand wavy it might be, as mine was, but they do have a very nicely structured and logical system of how their magic works, which in a sense almost becomes scientific. And I find it fascinating sometimes to read stories that do that. Creating one's own science from scratch, in a way.
Right. It's another thing that I've really enjoyed in the writing of Darryl Gregory.
Mm-hmm.
Because his characters are often, especially in the novels, his characters are often dealing with, phenomena that are obviously fantastic. They break our laws of physics, and not in a way that, you know, suggests an alternate physics. They just break things like the conservation of energy.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the characters are investigating these phenomenon as if they were, you know, as if it was science, because it's a real thing in their universe that they can test and experiment, and they want to understand.
Yeah, test, experiment, falsifiability. Exactly so. That's what you have as a structure of science. Yeah.
And it's odd to me that so little actual science fiction uses that structure.
It's true. What we have sometimes in science fiction is, and I almost feel as if I'm repeating something I heard on a Code Street podcast.
Yeah, it's quite common.
So I just want to say I'm very sorry if I'm actually repeating something that Gary has said or that Jonathan has said. But we do get these science fiction stories where it's more the trappings. You know, if it's got rockets, if it's got robots, if it's got stuff happening on other planets, then even if there's all kinds of hand-wavy stuff going on that isn't quite explained, it's still considered science.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was just saying, although there's a part of me that likes to think that there must be some leeway for hand-wavy stuff, because there's so much stuff we don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And there's so much stuff that we thought that we knew that we go back and we go, actually, no, that's wrong. And we change it. And, you know, I like to think that part of being able to write science fiction is being able to write stuff that you cannot even say that it's really plausible, because it's so out there. It's like trying to explain, you know, calculus to your dog. So I think there has to be a level of knowledge that our brain is just never going to be able to grasp. I would like to think that.
Well, I would agree with you up until that last point, because I agree there are lots of things we don't grasp now, and I think that we absolutely need to leave everyone room to tell the stories they want to tell, because, you know, there's so many just phenomenal stories that, yeah, I mean, it's absolutely shovel on the uranium until we break this little, you know, light speed. It's not real science, but it still can be a really fun story.
Absolutely.
But I've been doing in-depth studies of Greg Egan's work, and of course he's a super hard SF writer out of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And in his novel Incandescence, he very forcefully makes the, I pretty much have to call it an assertion, that there's nothing in the universe that the human brain cannot eventually understand.
Mm, okay, yes.
And he's pretty convincing about it. I'm not sure if it'll turn out to be true, but it's such a purely enlightenment philosophy that it is very attractive.
Right. I guess I wouldn't argue against that statement, but I would say that I don't know if it's a position that can be proved one way or the other we're in the midst of where we are.
Yeah, that's why I kind of had to back off. I'm like, yeah, I didn't want to say he stated the fact because that would be much too strong, but I think assertion is about as strong as we can put that now.
Yes. What I have seen in a few novels, and of course I can't even think of a title to throw at you, is the idea of, how to put it, our understanding of science, of course, is very much shaped by the way we perceive the world. So if you're going to be writing a story about an alien, truly alien, as opposed to sort of humans with funny ears, a truly alien culture discovering certain things about the universe, but they have a different perception of the universe, then, you know, the question of how they will come up with certain theories and even how their origin myths might tie in with that, all those sort of things. I've seen a few books do that and really make it look as if it's coming at it from a different angle. And when you mentioned that same book, I believe you're talking about, because you said it was the people who were actually inside a hollow world and couldn't see the stars, and we're creating an understanding of science or a perception of science that was not at all based on ours, which is very much we're on the surface looking out. Mm-hmm. I thought that was fascinating.
It is fascinating. And the only thing I might quibble with Egan's portrayal of the aliens in that universe is they seem very human. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not in this case authorial laziness. It really is. He's trying to make this point of the universality of the scientific method.
Right, yes.
And so because all their plot is focused on we need to figure out the physics of our universe so we can survive, it's going to look very much like any other culture doing physics.
Maybe what we've actually run into is not a problem with science, but a problem of literature. Anything that we write has to be human on a certain level, doesn't it?
Yeah, because otherwise it just becomes completely incomprehensible.
Yeah. I still remember reading, was it Fall of Hyperion?
Oh, beautiful stuff.
Which I really enjoyed. But I'll be perfectly honest and say that when it got into some of the conversations with some of the huge AIs, I was like, this works so well because I'm all at sea. I cannot grasp what this person is trying to convey.
Right.
And I think it was partly intentional and partly that Dan Simmons must be just a lot more intelligent than I am. but yes, you do get that point where, even though the person that he was speaking to was like our bridge to humanity in the sense that he too couldn't understand what was being said to him, there's a point at which you really are just going to lose that. Here we go back to that word again, communication.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't have the same frame of reference, you don't have the same vocabulary. There are all these tools that we just have to work with, and we can't just ditch them.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm thinking back on another Egan book. Of course, I'm going to be littering this whole discussion with Egan, because that's what I've been focusing on for, a year now. In his book Diaspora, in the first half of the book, there's a large portion of humanity that's gone and digitized themselves, and they're all living on servers somewhere.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then there's the portion of humanity that's decided to stay on the surface and be embodied.
Mm-hmm.
But even though, it's far enough in the future that even the people who are staying embodied are not simply hewing to the traditional human, genotype.
Right.
They're becoming aquatic creatures or arboreal creatures or whatever they want. And there's a really interesting thing where he doesn't get into it, which is almost a shame, but he describes a network of people who act as bridges to other, I almost want to call them mutated forms of humanity, because the communication starts to drift. When you've got some people who are living like, normal, just people, and some people who are living more like dolphins, it takes more effort to bridge that communication gap.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's, in a way, a scenario like that extrapolate kind of real world culture in a sense.
Yeah.
Where you can have people migrate from a central point, and then, well, depending on the time frame you're looking at, either you're going to have the cultural drift aspect, cultural and linguistic drift. But if you have a large enough time frame, then you are also talking about very significant genetic drift as well, possibly happening. So yeah, that's a good story. Yes, and of course, now I'm definitely going to have to read Egan.
Sorry, I don't mean to be an evangelist about him. It's not for everybody,
It's not that. It's that people have been... One of the amazing things about, you know, having these podcasts and listening to these podcasts and reading all this cool stuff is that I've got this to-read list that's now become unimaginable. Completely unmanageable.
Do you think you've hit the point yet where if you had nothing to do but read for the rest of your life, you wouldn't get through the to-read list?
I think I hit that point years ago.
Yeah.
I think that what happened to me was that I also, fortunately for my own sanity, hit the point where it was like, you know what? I'm just going to imagine... Oh, goodness, here we go. I can throw a name at you now. I think it's Richard Matheson who wrote I Am Legend.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He also wrote What Dreams May Come. And I think it was in that book, unless I'm dreaming entirely, but when he was describing heaven, and heaven had various aspects to it, but one of the things he described was a library where you not only had every book that was ever written, but every book that might have been written.
Right.
So whenever I think, I'm never going to get through my to-read list, I think, you know what, eventually I'll die and I'll go straight to that library and I won't move for a couple of eons, you know? It'll be fine.
Yeah, that's so, yeah. An afterlife worth hoping for.
Yeah, that's what I focus on. Yeah, because there's so many stories out there. In fact, there's only one thing I do regret, and maybe it's just paranoia on my part and it will pass, but whenever I hear... someone's novel that is kind of close to what I'm writing about, I'm scared to read it.
Oh yeah.
I feel like, you know, either it will be a case of I will absorb it more easily and accidentally plagiarize something,
mm-hmm.
or I will have been working on something which I thought was totally cool and original, and they will have already done it and done it better, and I will become completely demoralized and not be able to continue. So that's actually what I regret, because I'm beginning to realize I have cut out a chunk of my favorite stuff.
Oh, right.
For reading, because I'm like, no, let me finish this manuscript first. Dang. Anyway, sorry, babbling again.
No, that's got to be tough. I feel the same way about reviews. If I know I'm going to review a book, I have to avoid all the reviews of that book until I've got my thoughts down.
Oh my goodness. You see? Communication again.
Right.
But this time, contamination sense.
Exactly. No, yeah, I mean, communication's just central to everything we do.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was it. One of my least favorite things is I read one book where somebody... Okay, so imagine there's a home world, and then people traveled away from the home world, kind of either colonized or were fighting a centuries-long war on another planet.
Mm-hmm.
30,000 years later, they make it back to their home world.
And
they just start talking to their compatriots like no time had passed at all.
No.
Zero linguistic drift.
No. I know that there's some people who do feel that because we're so much more connected now in the globe, that eventually language will become more, I don't know if what's the right word, ossified perhaps?
Ossified because, or standardized?
Standardized, because we won't have the little pockets of isolation in which to you know, drift along happily in another direction. But if you're talking about two groups that were definitely separate, you know, with no continued back and forth, I can't see how that would happen.
Yeah, me neither. And I pretty much threw the book against the wall at that point.
Ouch.
Which was a shame, because it was a book that my brother had recommended to me, and I usually my brother and my tastes line up pretty well, and I was like, oh, really? Really?
Oh, man.
Yeah, he hadn't even noticed.
Well, it is, in a way, a very sort of early Star Trek thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that they managed to put in the whole universal translator thing to kind of make it all better. And I think there's a point at which you are willing to forgive these things more when you see them on screen, because there are definitely some types of story you cannot convey on screen the way you can in a book.
Absolutely.
So you accept on screen that, well, at least the days before your CGI, that your aliens are going to be humanoid. You accept that they're going to be speaking English, or at least have some decent subtitles and a universal translator around. Because, again, if you're going to have any kind of story at all, those are the kind of things that have to happen.
Right, and the other thing is just time constraints. I mean, you've either got, 45 minutes of a TV show or 2.5 hours of a movie, and if you take up the first 15 minutes with every time with, and now we have to learn the language.
Yes. Oh, man, yeah.
Really going to slow things down.
Yes.
But, yeah, it's absolutely critical. So Egan, again, he makes a point over and over of basically the universality of of math and science.
Yes.
And it's such an attractive notion, and of course it's what SETI's built on, and Carl Sagan, and and so much. But I just hope that someday we actually do find aliens, and we find out whether or not that's actually true.
Well, I'm going to argue a little bit counter.
Okay.
I think that I do believe in the universality of maths, because I think, well, we had a bit of a conversation about this before. So much of maths is like, how to put it? You're discovering something that's already there. You're the way the formulae, the constants, the regulations, the rules, regulations. Sorry, that's completely the wrong word, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
These are all things that, you know, you can have, you know, one country in one hemisphere discover it another time. The whole Newton and Leibniz, for example, that can happen very easily. Where science is concerned, especially when you're talking not just science that has a lot of math related to it, but also science in the sense of biology, in the sense of chemistry, and so on and so forth, you begin to have things like paradigms. Did you touch on any of that? That's more of a history of science concept. But when I use the term paradigm, do you know what I'm referring to?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So why I find it more a case of, well, can you talk about the universality of science? In a very pure sense, you could say, yes, science has these universal approaches and whatever. But in a real world sense, like, you know, human fallible creatures and human fallible societies are carrying out this endeavor, the reality is that there have been certain approaches to science and to interpretation of scientific data that have been very much culturally linked. And I say culturally not only in the sense of, be it, you know, culturally British or culturally German or whatever, but quite literally in the sense of this is a particular academic school of thought. School of thought sounds like a terrible thing to say for physics, but it happens.
No, it absolutely does. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, you have, for example, I mentioned earlier about people's scientific knowledge being stuck back in the early, late 19th century, early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And a large part of that is some of the paradigms were just so tainted with other things, with politics, with people's own wishes of how they want the world to be as opposed to how it really was.
Absolutely, yeah. Cultural resonances.
Precisely. So, you know, you get things like social Darwinism being completely warped in a way that kind of drifts away from what Darwin intended, even.
Oh, yeah.
What Darwin was looking at. You get aspects of, I would say, even, you know, kind of the pre-relativity scientific world, the one that was initially so inimical to Einstein's discoveries, again, had a particular view of the universe that was still something that could be pictured in the mind. It wasn't something that had all these, you know, wave-particle duality questions and all that sort of thing, where you were beginning to go into the realm of, you have to think of this more as going beyond, the reality is beyond the model you're trying to hold in your head. The model is to help you get the answers from the data, but it's not an accurate representation of what truly is. But people then held on to their models so tightly that when the model no longer worked, it couldn't go forward.
Right.
And that's why I come back to the idea that I still think that there's always going to be this problem, at least for humans. Maybe if some aliens are superior, they wouldn't have this problem. But humans, they form a model and they hold to that model. And you need a breakthrough. You need a paradigm change, or else you don't go forward.
Right, which often comes with a generational shift.
It does. It does. Okay. And it often comes at the expense of somebody being seen as, you know, either a crackpot or a quack or something like that. But again, what does happen, and this is where, as I said, you get the pure aspect of it, the theoretical aspect, when I say works in theory, eventually they get vindicated, because when things become testable, it can be tested.
Right, and the universe still does have the final say.
Precisely. So initially they couldn't test what Einstein was about because they didn't have the technology to do the testing. But eventually, with better observations in both astronomy and, you know, things like particle accelerators and whatever, they're able to say, hey, look at that. He was right. Darn. So, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I can easily believe that, you know, whenever we do meet aliens, we'll eventually be able to get to the point where we say, hey, have you observed the speed of light? And they'll throw out a number in whatever their numbering system is, and we'll have our number, and they should agree.
Mm-hmm.
Speed of light in a vacuum, I should specify.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And same thing with chemical elements and things mm-hmm. like that. Things where it's easy to point at something and agree on it.
And as you said, that's what SETI is based on. The whole question of the message that went to the stars. They try to put things on it that should be constants across at least this universe's experience.
Right. But once you get into I guess it's like watching the sausage be made. I've seen it in both the scientific community, scientific academic community, and the engineering community. It's so cultural, and it's so political, and it's so personality-driven. I mean, any team of humans, whether it's, you know, a diplomat sitting in an office somewhere, or engineers trying to work out a design problem, you know, you get these dynamics. You know, there's so many things that get affected, funding levels, priorities, where
exactly.
People choose to focus their efforts. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing that I've just noticed repeatedly, that Egan tends to elide.
Really? So there are no politics in his scientists are pure scientists in every sense of the word?
Basically. And especially in incandescence.
Now, this is where I have to mention a book that I actually mentioned on the last podcast I was on.
Uh-huh.
The only podcast I was on. I mentioned The Gods Themselves, Isaac Asimov.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that was cool because you did have alien scientists and they did have politics.
Right.
And
of
they
course...
did have, you know, okay, this stuff is going to destroy our universe, but we can't make them stop doing it, you know, which is kind of what happens to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something I appreciated when I read that one. But there again, you might say, are we making our aliens too human to do this? But I guess you've got to pick something. And I can more believe his way of doing it, that if you have people, if you have aliens who are sufficiently like us, then I think certain traits of the whole group dynamics and working together sort of thing are going to end up being constants in their own way.
Right.
People constants rather than constants of the universe.
yeah, absolutely. It's you know, the hoary cliche, it's just down to human nature.
Yeah, exactly.
Although, to be fair, with Egan, I'm thinking now that his near-future stuff
mm-hmm.
is more likely, you know, to have some of the politics of science. Permutation
right.
City had some of it. You saw it in Diaspora. You saw it more in Distress. And then the farther in the future he goes, the more he hopes, I don't want to say, I don't want to do too much authorial intention, but as a shorthand, the more he seems to hope that we'll leave all that behind us.
I think that it is possible that we could. I will actually, you know, say something positive for a change about that hope. Because, I mean, you remind me of another kind of near future story, which was Timescape, Greta Bedford.
Oh, yeah, that's one that's been on my list for forever, and I'm sorry to say I haven't read it yet.
Well, I think it's really worthwhile. I remember reading it. I actually read it when I was doing my bachelor's.
Oh, perfect.
And it was, yes, you know, the politics were in there, the kind of the whole inertia of we're doing, it was actually sort of impending environmental disaster. I think I can tell you that without, you know, taking spoiling it too much for you.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, this, of course, would have been, I read this back in the late 80s. And I can't remember exactly when it came out, but clearly at some point before then. And it was a question of, we know that this is going to be a problem, but we can't do anything to change it because governments and faculties and institutions move so slowly,
right,
in terms of actual change. You know, people become more concerned about protecting their tenure or protecting their term in office than they are about protecting, you know, a generation or two down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So that was actually pretty cool. But I do remember reading it and thinking to myself, in the context of history of science, there are things that get left behind in the way, in the kind of obstacles that we allow ourselves to have when we're dealing with science. And it is feasible to think that that could be left behind, but then I have to say, what's going to replace it? There's going to be some other kind of structure which will have some other kinds of problems attached.
Right. Yeah, you never get, no system's perfect.
Precisely.
Right.
And in fact, I need to talk about another science that gets overlooked a little bit, and that's sociology. Because, you know, soft sciences are always something that sometimes people look down on a bit when it comes to talking about sci-fi. But sociology permeates these things completely.
Yeah, even in the practice, I mean, from my point of view, especially in the practice of the harder sciences.
Exactly. And so much of sci-fi deals with worlds that you can't avoid it. Unless you do want to write a very focused story about, say, you know, two protagonists in an arena, which can be done very well, you know. Unless you want to do it like that, if you're going to be building worlds, you do have to think about sociology, and there are some marvelous stories that can be told that way.
Oh yeah, one that, again, I haven't read, but everyone just raves about, Gwyneth Jones' Aleutian Trilogy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I've heard just phenomenal things about the alien race that we encounter in that trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little more about it? I'm trying to think.
I haven't read it yet.
Oh, no problem. I'm trying to place it in a sense, because I'm sure somebody must have mentioned it to me. I'm just trying to figure out.
Yeah, it features fairly often in discussions of gender in science fiction, because the aliens in that trilogy have very alien notions of gender,
mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
map only with difficulty to what humans are used to.
Right.
And again, it comes down to communication issues.
Mm-hmm. This sounds like something that would have won a Tiptree.
It quite possibly, I would be shocked if it hadn't been shortlisted. I'm not sure if or which volumes may have won.
Okay, that may be where I've heard about it. I've been very good, you see. I've been doing a lot of reading around the genre, because it's kind of funny. You find yourself, and maybe in a way going to ICFA was what kind of kicked this off for me. You have your own favorites of the genre. You have your own little subgenres that are your kind of, you know, cozy comfort areas.
Yep.
And then you come into something like ICFA, where people are speaking in a very, you know, a very broad sense about what goes on, you know, from top to bottom. and you kind of sit there and go, yeah, I haven't read that one, and I'll make sure and then look that one up. Yes. So it's kind of funny. Like I said, I have this immense reading list that hasn't really been touched, but I've been consoling myself by, if I dare say it, going and reading a lot of summaries and reading about things and seeing who won which awards.
So
I won't sound like a total idiot in conversation.
No, if it weren't for some of the histories of the field, I would be completely at sea.
Mm-hmm.
I had the same experience. I first went to ICFA in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2007. And after I'd met, you know, I went to ICFA, and before that I'd met Gary Wolfe and Charles Brown at a WorldCon. I was just like, I need to read so much.
Don't they make you feel so like silly? Like when you hear people like Gary and Jonathan talking, you're kind of like, yeah, okay, and make some notes on the side here. What else you have to look up?
Oh yeah, Charles used to just sort of wheel me around the dealer's room and pull books out that I needed to buy and go read. he was very happy to spend my money for me.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
But yeah, one thing I've done is that I've spent a lot of time reading some of the historical stuff, but it's those summaries that point you at which ones are important and which ones you can skip.
True. That is very, very true. Yeah, it does give you more of a focus.
Which, thank goodness, because there's so much out there.
Yeah. Whew. And a lot of stuff that I would say has either been overlooked or has been, I don't quite want to say forgotten, but...
Fallen through the cracks, certainly.
Yeah. So,
but you know, I want to go back to your point about sociology, because I wonder if one of the things that you know, people say, oh well, they're the hard sciences and the soft sciences.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder with the quote unquote soft sciences, if it's just so much harder at this point in our history to everyone point to the same thing and talk about it, as opposed to, you know, the language gets fuzzy in those areas. So that everyone's kind of pointing at the same area, but they're pointing at different bits, or they're pointing at different angles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it's still, it still has that imprecision.
I think that the imprecision is what can actually help a storyteller.
And yeah, absolutely. I think it makes it so much more important for fiction.
And I guess, well, you see, sometimes... I have to admit, I have not personally encountered anyone who was very sort of stuck on the idea that hard sci-fi was in some way superior to soft sci-fi. I say personally, I have seen the arguments back and forth on the internet, various blog posts, essays, conversations, and comments. But I would have to say that right now, from my own point of view, in terms of what I've read and various friends of mine, male and female, what they read and they tend to like, that is a distinction, that kind of hierarchy where hard sci-fi somehow is superior or requires more talent to write, seems to me to be a carryover from the academic world, where if you wanted to have your sort of hierarchy of intelligence, I think that the mathematicians were right up there, followed by the engineering science people. Then the physics people kind of came in, sort of third. And then you kind of trickled down a bit. Civil engineering, I think, was a little below below physics. By the time you start looking at biology and don't even talk about sociology, there was just this sort of descending scale, which was completely arbitrary.
Right, and
purely cultural. For people's esteem, you know.
Right.
Students always need, I think, to be able to look down on another group and say, well, I may be getting C's, but they're more superior C's because this is a harder course.
I'm ashamed to say that in my freshman dorm, we in the physics department were, you know, slaving away forever over our, you know, tests and exams and homework sets and getting B's if we were lucky and A's if we were really lucky. And we'd watch the education majors.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, my homework's so hard. I've got so much homework. I have to make a poster. And we're sitting there with a stack of textbooks this high, you know, and they're like, yes. I'm going to kill you. And your GPA is so much higher than mine.
I know. But you see, in a way, that's not so much to do with the subject as the way the subject is structured.
Good point.
There are some things that are, you could say, easier to learn or easier to present or easier to be tested on. But it doesn't mean that the content itself is of lesser value.
Absolutely. And the other thing I was thinking, bringing it back to the context of fiction, is that some hard SF is, I'm going to steal a word from Clute, it's harder to make storyable.
Ooh, yes. I'm completely with you on that. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons why it has the esteem that it has is people look and go, wow, that was tricky to do. You really had to set that up. That looked hard. Whereas the more sociological things, because they're more intuitive in a way, everyone lives in society, then people go, that's not that hard. But of course, it's still extremely hard to do very well.
Well, this is the thing. I've seen, oh goodness, it's so easy to do badly. It's so normal to see it done in a mediocre sense. But no one seems to call it out as much. I mean, you mentioned, for example, the whole, here are these two cultures that seem to have experienced no linguistic drift whatsoever over 30,000 years.
Right.
Now, if somebody were to look at something and say, they're totally ignoring the principle of conservation of energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be looked upon as the most terrible sin you can commit as a science fiction, a hard science fiction author.
Right.
But the situation you've just described, to me, is as equally sinful, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It just depends on maybe where your heart is, where your interests lie, what really jumps out at you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I think that there are, when you see it done really well, when you see someone do the psychology and sociology of a story really well, it stands out, and it may be that it's probably one of those things that, because it seems easy to get by, people don't think about it. But then they overlook the times that you have to really be a virtuoso to do it extremely well. Those ones are still very rare.
Right, and that's got to be one of the reasons why Ursula Le Guin is so revered, is because she did. You know, was one of the first people to go, no, I'm going to treat this with exactly as much rigor as any of the sciences.
Exactly. I know that there is a lot of some of the hard sci-fi that has been subject to the criticism that the characters are kind of cardboard cutouts, or some of their actions are implausible, or even sometimes the society seems more like a convenient context or backdrop for the science to play out. And these are all lapses of sociology and psychology. And I say lapse, and I want to be clear, I'm not trying to be judgmental here. You can't know everything, okay? You cannot know everything. You can do your research, and as good writers, I'm sure we all do.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, there are going to be things that you either have a better handle on, because maybe that's where your initial studies lie, or that you find it easier to intuitively grasp what they're supposed to be about. So you are going to find areas of weakness when it comes to world building, because we're talking world building in its most complete sense, where you're talking about not only how the physical world works, but also how the human/alien, the people world works. And that's a lot of story. That is a lot of story to get right. So, I would just say to people, be gentle with one another. None of it is easy. All of it has its complexity and difficulty. We should all be just celebrating when it gets right and happy.
That would be wonderful.
It would. That was a bit kumbaya, wasn't it? Oh, well.
Well, I have to admit, I feel as a nonfiction person and as a reviewer and a critic, who I personally could not write fiction if you put a gun to my head. I mean, so I try as much as I can.
You're not going to give me the usual, oh, I've been thinking of writing a book one of these days, everybody has at least one book in them? You're not going to say that?
I'm not going to do it. Okay, some of my family, when I say, well, I'm a writer as well as being an engineer, they go, oh, well, when are you going to write a novel? And I'm like, no. Why would I stop doing something I'm decent at and start doing something I'd be horrible at?
Oh, dear.
But I always remember, and I try and be charitable, because no matter how much some literature just does not work for me on certain levels. Anybody who's written a coherent story with a beginning and a middle and an end has done something that I could not do.
Yeah. And the thing is, for me as well, and here is, this is the praise now I have to give to reviewers. I am one of these terrible, terrible people who doesn't know literature but knows what she likes.
Okay.
Which is to say, there are times when people might want to get my objective opinion on whether or not a book is good. I tend to refer them to reviewers who I trust, because very often I can quite dislike a book that I recognize objectively as good, I'm still not able to separate that, the sort of the visceral gut feeling it gives me, and the kind of, well, okay, leaving all those old triggery bits aside, was it a good book? You know, I think a good reviewer can do that.
Yeah, I think the best can. Actually, I think that's one of the reasons why people think that Gary Wolf doesn't write negative reviews.
Uh-huh.
It's because he tends not to focus on his own visceral reactions.
And
he can pretty much always point out what the author's done and, you know, how successful the author's been at doing whatever it was that he or she set out to do.
Exactly.
And put the whole book in context of the broader field, which, of course, is what Gary is just, you know, brilliant at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he doesn't use triggering words like, I hated this or this sucks.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, well, to me, those are the kind of reviews that are useful, because it allows me to, rather than having to find a reviewer whose taste matches mine, I can look at somebody like Gary and say, well, you know what? He's actually got a broad view. And I can look at the things I know that I like and see when he's referring to those and figure out that's going to be a book that I will like. That's far more useful to me.
Yeah, which is why, I mean, you know, reviewers of Gary's caliber are few and far between.
Yeah. I do still find it amusing when I see someone, usually someone who's, well, I was going to say quite new to it. Someone who's quite new to reviewing, starting off with a kind of a, oh, I hated this book kind of attitude. And then they go on to talk about their pet peeves. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, in terms of a snarky blog post, this was fun to read. But in terms of an actual review that told me about this book, this was not useful.
Yeah, there's a, I fell into that trap. I first tried my hand at reviewing in 2004. If you ever go search, one of the first reviews I ever published was in Strange Horizons. It was of Greg Egan's Shield's Ladder. It is so over the top with fangirl love that I'm entirely embarrassed. And the one that was worse was my attempt to review Appleseed by John Clute, which was so incredibly ignorant that I have actually had it removed from the internet. And after realizing how disastrous that review was, I stopped reviewing for 2 years. And actually just went, you know what, I need to read more before I try this again.
No, hang on. I gotta fangirl you for a little bit now, because that level of self-awareness is rare. Rare and wonderful. I wish more people had it. You know, just knowing when you've hit point of your limitation and you need to go away and learn a bit more is not something that some people seem to be able to do.
Well, I figured that the internet could be spared that 2 years worth of my learning process.
Do you hear that, internet? More of you need to be the latest person, really. Anyway, let me stop embarrassing you.
Although, to be fair, not that I still didn't have a whole bunch of learning to do when I got back into it in 2006, but was at least more on the level of, you know, prose style and structure and...
Yes. I like to think, in fact, okay, I like to say to people that one of my favorite authors is C.S. Lewis.
Oh, okay.
And it's not because I universally like everything he's ever written. There's some things he's written that I really, 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 it makes me cringe to even remember some of the scenes. But what I like about him so much is that he improved. Mm. He could see the arc of his growth. And if there's one thing I would love to do is to be able to... I want to be able to look back at my first work and cringe a little bit, because that will tell me that I have you know, got better, as opposed to, oh, look, see, that was my nice flash in the pan way back when. I didn't get any better after that.
I suppose in that case the former scenario is preferable, but I hope that that you'll never look back at Redemption and Indigo and cringe, because it's such a beautiful story.
I'm glad that you like it. I have to admit, though, there are little parts of it. I probably shouldn't say this. There are some small parts of it that I look at and I'm going, damn, that sentence is clunky. Why did I do that? I would say there are little bits of it that make me cringe.
Okay.
But overall, I am happy with it still, which is good.
Good, yeah.
I think that it's kind of funny. The length of the whole publishing process, especially for a first novel, is so lengthy that I sometimes have to remind people, I first wrote this, as in completed a first draft, back in 2003, late 2003.
Oh my goodness.
So in many respects, I am looking back at a younger version of myself.
Absolutely.
I am looking back at myself before I did my MPhil and my PhD and learned a little bit more about structuring lengthy bits of prose. And I'm also looking at myself before I did certain types of reading on psychology and various other things. So it's not a surprise that I would feel, you know, as you know, that I'm kind of almost looking at somebody different when I look at that. I like to think that the core is solid. And I'd also like to think that even if there are bits that I think a sentence can be tweaked, that the actual content of the sentence, the direction of the thing, is not something that I would want to change too much. And you have to let it go. It's like a child, you know?
Right.
You can't be kind of like, no, you stay here. I haven't finished raising you. Like, get out into the world, suffer, do something, whatever. Just stand on your own 2 feet.
Yeah, at a certain point, you just have to kick it out the door and go write the next thing.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah.
Although there's one more point I want to address with sociology, and then I'm thinking of the sociology of science.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've noticed, and I started out talking about Daryl Gregory a little bit, and mm-hmm. I've also seen this a little bit with Ted Chiang, where they can actually take the sociology of science and the scientific method and import it completely successfully into a fantasy universe.
And
I think that it's because sociology is the softer and fuzzier thing that they can make that transition and make it brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what you did in Redemption and Indigo also to a more backgrounded extent. And it's odd because Daryl and Ted can do in a fantasy what is incredibly rare to see done even in a true, you know, hard SF book,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, actually use the real process of science.
You've just made me think of something. You know, everything has its flip side. Maybe what we're seeing in some of those science fiction novels is a attempt to put mythology into a sci-fi setting, create a mythology of science.
Oh.
Because isn't that what George Lucas said he was doing? I mean, when he was developing Star Wars and, you know, it was all Hero of the Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell, etc., etc.
Uh-huh.
That was very much, as we said, you know, the trappings of science, you know, spaceships, laser beams, etc.
Yeah.
But the core of it was actually myth.
Right. Yeah, I've ever since I've understood more about the difference between science fiction and fantasy, I can't see Star Wars mm-hmm. as anything other than a fantasy because of the way it's structured.
Right, exactly. So in a way, you know, I mean, people have had this discussion about you know, genre boundaries not being very helpful sometimes.
Yeah.
But in a way, perhaps what we're looking at, if we want to look at the structure as opposed to the veneer, you have logical systems stories, and you have what I will call myth-oriented stories.
Yeah, and either genre can use either structure.
Precisely, precisely. Now, this is fascinating.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. And it's just that the process of science is relatively, how do you say, it's new to our culture.
Yes.
It's not necessarily the most intuitive way of thinking for a lot of people.
Yes.
And so I think you just see so many fewer stories that are structured that way in either genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because even so many of your awesome space opera stories, you know, to the extent they're using real science instead of hand waving, a lot of times they're engineering stories.
Engineering stories, or my personal favorite, believe it or not, tends to use aspects of biology.
Oh, yeah.
I'll give an example. This was an episode of Next Generation Star Trek that I saw way back when, and it really stuck with me, partly because it scared the living daylights out of me. And it was the one where, some other sci-fi MacGuffin thingy had happened, and they ended up finding the ship which had everybody dead except for one Betazoid, who was catatonic. And they couldn't figure out what had happened. And then whatever happened on that ship started happening with them. People were sleeping, but they weren't dreaming.
Yes. Okay, yes, I remember that one.
Right. And so they started having these hallucinations. And when I saw that, let me tell you how I know science fiction is good science fiction. If you make me go and research the darn thing, if I have to go and actually say, wait a minute, this is based on something that's real, and I have to go to the internet or the encyclopedia or whatever is to hand to the library. That was actually in the days before the internet, so I did go to the library. If I have to go to the library and look something up and say, wow, okay, cool, I see where they got this from, that's what stands out to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I had that experience just with a very recent book. Joan, oh goodness, let me try and pronounce her last name. Slonczewski?
Okay. I'm not able to correct you, so we can go ahead with that.
I've never heard it pronounced. It's Slonczewski. She's a biology professor at Kenyon University.
Okay,
I've never really studied biology in depth, but she's written this very totally comfortable calling it hard SF novel, except that the hardness comes from biology instead of physics.
Right.
It's called The Highest Frontier. It's going to be released in September. I just finished a review of it for Cascadia Subduction Zone. And
cool.
She does a lot with the concept of doing macro engineering using anthrax bacteria.
Really?
Yeah. And I had just no idea how that could work. But it was a fascinating concept. I was really curious, and I went and Googled a bit of it. And then in my review, I said I could have used a little more info dumping on that topic in the book. But
the fact
that I cared enough
speaks
wonders of how well she did her world building.
Yes. And I think there are quite a few books, when I look back on it, that I think about, that are really good, especially for students. Sorry, I'm talking about students before university now. For students to be reading, precisely because when you are in school and everything seems very dry and whatever, to be able to pick up a sci-fi novel and to say, oh, look, cool, I learned about this, this actually has applications or whatever. I think that means a lot. I think it really does.
Oh, certainly. Certainly.
Yeah.
I think that's why so many people have talked about being inspired to pursue science and math careers because of science fiction. It injects drama into something that's so often boring.
Yes, it's true. Oh, I have another example of that, but it's not science. You're going to laugh. Terry Pratchett's Jingle.
Okay.
Jingle came out as a paperback around the same time that I was doing a course in international law.
Okay.
And it was so funny because the whole bit about the law of the sea and so on, which is, of course, something we pay a lot of attention to because we're an island.
Oh, yeah.
And we're an island with a lot of other islands around and continent not too far away as well. And there are all kinds of issues with the borders and the exclusive economic zone and all sort of thing. So here is a story. I don't know if you read Jingo at all.
I think I have not gotten there yet. I've read up to a certain point in Discworld, and I've been reading them in order, so I haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, gotta read them in clumps, you know, like the guards clump and the witches clump, and that kind of works. But anyway, this one, without spoiling you, because you're going to enjoy it, basically concerns what happens when an island rises up from the sea.
Okay.
And two countries try to claim it.
Ha ha.
And I was just over the moon. I went to my tutor and I was like, you have to read this. This is what we're discussing right now. And I was like, shoot, I haven't felt this way since I was, you know, reading about various galactic systems or whatever with Asimov and Clark.
Right.
So yeah, I love it when a book does that. And it doesn't have to be just the hard science. It can be a fantasy novel that uses an aspect of history really well.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be, as I said, the whole question of psychology. I mean, I've encountered some crime novels that do certain aspects of psychology so well that I have found myself going, oh, let me do some research on that mass murderer. Wow, isn't that fascinating? A bit gory, but, you know,
right.
If you can make me do that, you get kudos from me.
Absolutely.
Whatever the subject is, whether it's physical. I mean, okay, one of my absolute favorites, Flatland.
Oh, yeah.
My goodness. Yep. No, that is not even sci-fi. That's like math-fi, isn't it?
Yes. And old school math-fi.
Yeah. Oh, man. Utterly, utterly love that story. And do you know what's amazing about it is that, and this is, again, why I say that it's all intertwined. It is a math story, yes, but there's a lot of commentary in there about society, contemporary society at the time.
Yeah, and culture.
And there's also a lot of commentary about theology.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And just a little bit, enough of a individual psychology as well to really make the characters, you know, just stand out, even though they're literally two-dimensional.
Literally, yeah.
So I absolutely adore that book, and it's just a slender little thing, and it's got so much packed into it. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm kind of wishing that I were by my bookcase right now so I could like flip through these things, but then this would turn into a very, very long podcast.
Yeah, that is the risk when people actually have the books at their fingertips. It's like no wait.
Yeah, you know, look, I want to read you this a bit. This is cool. That would happen, trust me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah.
Okay, well, with that, we've been talking for about an hour.
Wow. You're good. That went like nothing.
I know, time flies. But I did want to give you a chance. Obviously, we've talked a little bit about the novel that you have out right now, Redemption and Indigo.
Yes.
Did you want to talk at all about what you're working on now?
Well, I will be working on editing The Best of All Possible Worlds for publication with Del Rey and with Joe Fletcher Books.
Mm.
And I am really looking forward to that because a lot of what... I didn't know to what extent I should be talking about my next thing. So right. A lot of what we discussed actually has to do with that. When you talked about the cultures who are split apart and come back and talk and they're speaking the same language.
Uh-huh.
Well, my story is kind of based on this planet, where the idea is that the planet is, in fact, populated by humans from Earth, but specifically humans who've been sort of plucked up at moments of war and disaster and whatever, where they were in danger of genocide or what have you, and they were transplanted this planet by other more advanced beings, okay?
Okay.
So what you have is a planet that is inhabited by Earth people that has stemmed from Earth cultures and Earth languages, that in a way still looks back to Earth, what news it can get of and from Earth in a very nostalgic sort of way. And that's my way of hand waving the fact that you can understand most of what's going on.
Ah, okay.
So yeah, there are all kinds of, you know, because it's kind of funny, you do sometimes write this stuff and you're like, but this doesn't work. I need to find an excuse for it. Ah, that'll hand wave that one over. So that was what happened to me there. And I almost don't want to say more about it. It came out of a lot of things. It came out of when the new Star Trek movie came out, and I think it's safe to not spoil anybody by saying that Vulcan was destroyed.
Yeah, that should not be a surprise to people at this point.
Yeah, so someone was talking about it and saying, well, you know, imagine if more women died than men. And I immediately went back to when I was in Wales doing my MPhil, and that was when the Boxing Day tsunami struck.
Oh, goodness.
And they did indeed have societies where the women and children were, you know, the societies, the death toll was incredibly higher, and you had unbalanced societies. And then, of course, you do also have situations like in China where, because of the one-child policy, you get gender imbalances there. And I was reading, you know, some of the stuff that happened, you know, some of the ways that people were trying to deal with this. And I thought to myself, I kind of want to write about this. But in a way, that's why science fiction fantasy works for me, because I know that there are people who are very good at researching, who could make it a real world story, who could pick it up and do a story about somebody who had experienced a disaster, wiping out half their town or whatever, and do it in a way that was respectful and knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still a bit chicken, so I can make it completely like fantastical, where, you know, I've completely invented this culture and these people and so forth. I'll make it something completely different. But the idea, the mere idea, that, you know, you're a young man who's suddenly like, you know, I kind of thought I'd get married and have kids someday. Where are the women? You know?
Right.
What's life going to be like for you? You know, what's going to happen? How are you going to try to rebuild? So that's kind of where that story came from.
Wow. Very cool. Well, we certainly look forward to it.
Thank you for letting me say a little bit about it. Thank you.
No problem. That's
feels like it's bubbling up inside me. And I'm like, Karen, just calm down.
That's what we're here for. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
And thank you, because I love to talk about science. You've tapped into my other passion, as it were.
I know, and I love whenever I can actually combine sort of I almost think of them as the two halves of my brain or the two halves of my life.
Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to you at some point in the future.
I believe we will. You take good care.